One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits, revisiting our series, The Political Editors, which we brought you earlier this year. This is episode 3 with Sir Peter Riddle, a veteran of Westminster politics, who became Times political editor in 1991.
I don't think that other people in the world would share the view that there is mounting chaos.
Where there is discord, may we bring harmony.
It is time to put up or shut up.
A new dawn has broken, has it not?
This is a decisive moment for the world economy.
Now the decision has been made to leave, we need to find the best way.
Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed.
I have been repeatedly assured that there was no party.
Growth and growth.
Some mistakes were made.
Half a century of politics told by the people who wrote the first draft of history for The Times. This is The Political Editors. On this episode, Sir Peter Riddle, who replaced Robin Oakley in 1991, recalling the dramatic end of the Thatcher era, underestimating John Major, and Labour coming back from the wilderness.
I had a couple of blokes on my team who were in there. I was standing outside, Thatcher comes out and comes up to me and said, "Mr. Riddle, you didn't ask your usual question this morning, you know, as if I'd missed school." He always lacked self-confidence because he'd never been to university, surrounded by all these brilliant people who went to university, to which the only answer is, look at what you achieved. Tony Blair in the 90s was conveying a sense of excitement. Now, some of it one could view as slightly shallow in some respects, some of it was, but there was a sense of change.
Peter Riddle, welcome to Times Radio. You replaced Robin Oakley as political editor of The Times in 1991, but not for very long. Tell us what happened.
Oh, essentially, my period as writing about politics is divided in two parts. One for the Financial Times, which I did basically up till 1991, and then from 1991 to 2010. But I wasn't really a political editor in the conventional sense of being the chief news correspondent, because I'd done that on the FT. And when I was hired by The Times, I was really being chief political commentator. So there was a playing around of titles. That didn't really matter. Phil Webster was in charge of news for the period when Robin Oakley left. I was the chief commentator doing analysis and so on.
And actually, the two of you rubbed together. We'll hear from Phil later in the series, but the two of you rubbed together for quite a long time doing that.
Absolutely. We did it, well, effectively for the best part of that period, let's say 18 years of doing it together, until I retired from The Times and did lots of other things in 2010, after the 2010 election.
We'll come on to those other things a bit later on. Let's go back to 1991 when you took over.
Yeah.
Tory party, change leader, economic crises and infighting, Labour Party on the march, they're about to win the general election.
That was interesting. I'd come back from the States. I've been in the States for 3 years. My last job on the FT, and that's where I was hired from in fact, by my later editor, Peter Stoddard, who was my opposite number in Washington. And I came back in the autumn of 91, and the things looked rather good for Neil Kinnock. I'd known John Major well in his rise, but he'd become... And I talked to him once or twice when he became Prime Minister, but it did look as if he was fighting an uphill battle. But then we had the election in the spring of 1992 when the polls got it wrong, and they got it badly wrong. They underestimated Major. And the interesting thing about Major is even though he got a narrow majority in seats, in terms of vote, he got one of the highest votes the Tories have had.
More votes than anyone ever in a general election.
And the famous thing in the election was... It was the kind of doggy John Major. He was on his soapbox, and people derided it. But it went down well with the public.
Paddling up to the Liberals for support is like leaning on candy floss. Not a chance of much support from that particular quarter.
And at the same time, people still had doubts about Labour. That Neil Kinnock had done a lot to change Labour, but the election results showed he hadn't done enough. And he immediately stepped down. And so it was a very strange period, because when Major won, you thought, this is a real triumph for him. But immediately everything went sour because of Europe, inevitably. And the battles over what became the Maastricht Treaty, which I don't want to talk about too much from the listener's point of view, but that dominated politics for the following 18 months. But you know, immediately the gloss went over his extraordinary election victory.
Coming from America back into British politics, did you have a different perspective on what was happening? Could you see that John Major stood a better chance of winning than maybe people right in the thick of the bubble might have thought?
Not really, because I think that, one, I'd kept in fairly close touch. I remember I was with the elder Bush in Paris at the time Thatcher fell. And I remember going to a press conference at the British Embassy, where Bernard Ingham was, and chatting to Bernard about her chances. Within 2 days, she'd announced her resignation. And so... One of the interesting things was explaining to American friends how we could do this. You know, how, remember, this is the middle of a war, the first Gulf War. Everyone thinks of the Iraq War, but you've got to remember the original one, the invasion of Kuwait and the expulsion very successfully and so on. And at that period, you know, Thatcher, who'd been at some distance from Bush, so it was quite interesting perspective being in Washington, very interesting perspective actually, but they'd come together again because of the Saddam Hussein invading Kuwait. But they couldn't believe that, how can you get rid of a successful prime minister? And as always, people overseas don't necessarily get the right perspective on what's happening domestically.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things. I was in a slightly unusual position because I still kept in touch with people. British politicians coming through Washington always wanted to gossip with me. And so I kept in touch in a way. So I was less detached than I might otherwise have been.
And what about John Major as a person? Because there's a whole generation of people now where the sort of the two-dimensional view of John Major is it's the grey man, his shirt tucked into his pants, eating peas. But you don't get to be in quite quick succession, Foreign Secretary, Chancellor, and then Prime Minister, and then win a general election, without being a pretty astute politician.
Oh, he was extremely astute. He's one of the most impressive politicians I knew, but he lacked self-confidence. He always lacked self-confidence because he'd never been to university. And you know, I've argued with him. I see him occasionally because we're both Surrey cricket fans, so I'm more likely to talk to him about cricket than politics. But he still has that feeling, look, I didn't go to university, surrounded by all these brilliant people who went to university, to which the only answer is, look at what you achieved. Yeah. And it's complete rubbish. I mean, interestingly enough, some of the top Mandarin civil servants regard him as one of the sharpest and cleverest prime ministers and the most painstaking at doing things. But he had that doubt. All the time as prime minister, he had doubt. And also, he was affected by a bitterly divided Conservative Party, which didn't help. But no, he was a much cooler, also calculating person. He was one of the most adept handlers of the press during his rise. If you asked, I mean, everyone focuses on Tony Blair, Peter Mandelson and Gordon Brown, but if you looked at someone who was a single person, on his own, without any entourage, cultivated the press during the 80s and 90s, it was him. He picked out some younger political journalists. He cultivated us, and it was a very smart move. He was actually a much smarter operator than people gave him credit for, but he was beset by an impossible party.
Yeah. Talk about the 1992 election. One of the standout moments of that election campaign was the Sheffield rally.
This is the Labour Party. This is the party that's going to win the election and win for our country.
Yeah, I mean, that was one I wasn't there. I watched it on TV and I thought, bit over the top. It jarred at the time, and it's convenient to look back on that and say that was the reason. But if you look at the gap in vote, I think it was people weren't yet ready for Labour. They were worried about at a time of recession. Remember, this is not a strong economic time.
Yeah.
It was a time of recession, house price collapse, interesting parallels with around now, and so on. And that people didn't feel safe with Labour. For all that Neil Kinnock had done over a period of 9 years, it wasn't quite enough.
And were all the seeds of that sown, essentially, in the 70s, when you first started, when you were at the FT and your economics correspondent, and you had Wilson and then Jim Callaghan and all the economic problems there? Was that still the hangover, what, 10, 12 years later?
I think there was some hangover, and as well as, of course, the switch to the left under Michael Foot in the early 80s. The famous Labour manifesto in 83, the longest suicide note in history, as it was described, and there have been longer ones since then, of course. But that sense of Labour being out of touch with reality, and it was just a slow climb back. I mean, it took three general elections to get back from the low point of 83, and Neil Kinnock did an awful lot to save Labour, very bravely and so on. But no, it was a legacy of the winter of discontent in 78, 79, the famous rubbish on the streets, all that stuff, combined, of course, with the enormous impact of Thatcher. I mean, she was a force of nature, certainly one of the most remarkable people I've ever covered as a journalist.
Did you feel, because she was there for such a long time and you were political at the FT at the time, do you feel you got to know her? Was she someone who cultivated you like others did?
No, that's a very interesting point, Matt. She did cultivate editors and kind of her sympathetic economists. She knew us all. Unlike other leaders, I mean, for example, later on, John Major, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, to some extent David Cameron, who were more contemporary, or indeed younger in Cameron's case, whom you could have a proper conversation with. With Thatcher, it was the headmistress's presence.
And what a policy! Yes, he would rather have the poor poorer, provided the rich were less rich. That is a liberal policy.
My favourite story of that was in the 87 election. I'd stayed behind, there were then daily press conferences, which aspect of
during the election campaign, every morning,
every party a weekday, round Smith Square in Westminster, the parties, starting off with the Libs, Lib Democrats, very early, then you'd be Labour, then you'd be the Tories. And so you move from one to the other. And I'd stayed at Labour to talk to Neil Kinnock about something. And the Tory press conference room was full. That didn't matter because I had a couple of blokes on my team who were in there. I was standing outside, Thatcher comes out with Norman Tebbit, her party chairman, and comes up to me and said, "Mr. Riddle, you didn't ask your usual question this morning, as if I'd missed school." I said, "No, I explained what I've been doing," and she wanted to know what Neil Kinnock said, so we had a conversation. Then she said, "You want to know what happened at my press conference?" Which was a completely absurd thing, given I had someone there. Norman Tebbit was standing behind her, because remember, Mrs. Thatcher wasn't that tall, was trying to stop laughing at this absurd thing, and she was waving her hand. Very Thatcher. It was the headmistress instructing, that was her relationship. And so you never got that close to her, but she was quite accessible in the sense of press conferences, but they tend to be rather gladiatorial, harm in that. But that was her style, and that's why Bernard Ingham, who died earlier this year, was such an important figure, because he was very much the interpreter. He wasn't a crony of Thatcher. People misjudge that. He was below stairs. If you think of it as Downton Abbey or upstairs, downstairs for the older listeners, he was a kind of butler.
As a press secretary, he was the one communicating, running up and down the stairs.
Yeah, running up and down the stairs, very accurately interpreting her will.
Yeah.
And he was very much personal to her. I mean, he was devoted to her.
You talked about John Major having self-doubt and that partly, carrying him through. Do you think in that period of recovering Thatcher, I mean, but certainly by the end she wasn't someone wracked by self-doubt. In fact, it was probably a bit overconfidence that played a part in that. Was that as a result of her being there for so long?
Yes. I mean, I think being there so long, I mean, a lot of people felt that, she should have gone after 10 years, that going on for 11 and a half she did was just too long, and she was isolated. The bunker was there. I mean, everyone I've talked to, and both at the time and subsequently, said, look, she just got isolated in there. She'd lost Geoffrey Howe, or Nigel Lawson first, the Chancellor. Yeah. All right, she'd been distanced from them, but they were the pillars of early Thatcherism as successive Chancellor's Exchequer. So losing them and other ministers, William Whitelaw was no longer around, he'd had a stroke, who'd been very much the person who supported her and helped her along on things. So she was isolated, and I only saw this right at the end because I was in the States, but you saw that sometimes her judgment was a bit strange. I mean, the end of the Cold War, which had been a great objective, she was very opposed to immediate unification. I remember being in Washington. American people, even ones who knew Britain pretty well, I say, what the hell's going on with you people? Well, this has been an objective, yet she's kicking up trouble over it. And as I say, it was only the Gulf War which brought Bush and her together.
Well, let me first welcome Prime Minister Thatcher back to the United States. It's a very timely visit.
This is The Political Editors, Episode 3 with Sir Peter Riddle. Coming up, how similar is Keir Starmer to Tony Blair? How the job of political editor has changed over the years? And whether Peter has enjoyed being on the other side, working in public office and answering rather than asking journalist questions?
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
This is part 3 of The Political Editors speaking to Sir Peter Riddle.
So you were still at the Times, but you weren't political editor.
Yeah.
You were chief political commentator.
Yeah.
What a period to have been covering from 92 when Labour lost the election, the death of John Smith in 94, the rise of New Labour. Today people say, oh, the mood around Keir Starmer and Labour is nothing like what it was in that period in the mid-90s. What was it actually like in the mid-90s to be covering it?
It was, I mean, obviously there are some similarities. You had a divided party. I mean, you know, drawing parallels between Margaret Thatcher and Boris Johnson might appear very bizarre. But there was a sense of the king, queen over the water. During the major years, you had still people who felt she'd been betrayed and so on. Even though my view is just the passage of time and you know, she'd lost her touch. And there are now people who think Boris Johnson was betrayed. So there's a parallel. I mean, one shouldn't take it too far. Very different, very, very different personalities, very different levels of achievement. But there's that aspect of it. You've got a divided government, one which is hitting problems with house prices. I mean, John Major had in his favour that after the immediate economic problems after 1992, the economy was recovering. Living standards were rising, but it was a kind of voteless recovery.
Yeah.
Here, living standards are being squeezed. It's much harder. With Labour, remember that it took a long time for Labour to recover from its 83. I mean, essentially, it's 14 years.
Yeah.
What Keir Starmer's tried to do is in 4 to 5 years from a pretty low base. So there are similarities. There are similarities in the ruthlessness in which they're trying to get the right candidates in place. It lacks some of the buzz. I mean, you know, Keir Starmer, who's a talented, able man, doesn't have some of the pizzazz that Tony Blair had at his peak.
Please welcome the Prime Minister of the Right Honourable, Tony Blair.
I mean, what he succeeded in doing, Tony Blair, in the 90s, really up till the 97 election, was conveying a sense of excitement. Now, some of it one could view as slightly shallow in some respects. Some of it was carefully orchestrated in media terms. But there was a sense of change around. I mean, it was quite clear by the mid-90s there was practically no way the Tories could win that election. So there is a different feel, however much the polls are similar. It's not quite the same as then.
I wanted to ask you about how the job of being a political journalist has changed. Because, well, in 1991, you become political editor of the Times. Well, you could go out for a great big long lunch and come back and write one story at tea time, and that was you done and dusted. These days, you'd be flat out morning live blogs and emails and Twitter and rolling news channels.
Can I push it back 10 years before that?
Okay.
Because I think that gives the contrast.
Yeah.
When I started, there were three TV channels. There was no breakfast TV. There was no Sky. Tim Berners-Lee was a bright spark, but not yet the internet. Mobile phones. People had clunky phones in cars. So the news cycle was, you know, as you imply, you wrote for a story for the evening main edition, say 7 o'clock or something. Well, interesting enough, you also wrote for later editions. I mean, I quite often, in my 1980s period as a political journalist, would be rewriting for the second edition. News would come in late. Parliament also sat late. I mean, there's no family-friendly hours. I mean, you were quite frequently during the week, it would be till 10, 11 o'clock. I mean, I'm single then, probably fortunately for my relationships and later family life. You worked late, which also had a great advantage. You got to know politicians much better. Yeah. I mean, I got to know them much better than I think a lot of people do now, because you really did rub shoulders with them in the evening. But that, as you say, has all changed. The technological changes have made a massive impact. Many of them are strong pluses. There's much more transparency. There's more openness. However, it does also make it more instant. Judgment has to be instant. You can't reflect. You can't go around and talk to two or three people, which, you know, I would be talking to several people, wander around Parliament, wander around the lobby, be on the phone, but I didn't have to reach a judgment within 5 minutes.
It's interesting what you say, though, about how you'd think that technology, WhatsApp, Twitter, has increased connectivity. Mm. But because they're less human relationships, your understanding and knowledge of what's going on is probably less.
It can be less. And since the curse of life is the breaking news phenomenon, the belief that something new is more significant, it isn't always. And I mean, the inevitable problem when you've got 24-hour news or you look at Twitter, you could say, well, actually, what is the most significant thing? When I started out, it was possible to establish significance and proportion. There were downsides. It was a very closed world.
Yeah.
Also, a heavily male world. I mean, you know, I had on the FT two deputies who were women. One went on to be the Channel 4 political editor, Alan Goodman. That was slightly unusual in what was a mainly middle-aged, quite tight world. And when some of the criticism made of the lobby now appears to be slightly ludicrous, because it was a closed world then, but it was just opened up by 24-hour news and everything we've seen since then.
Yeah.
So there were pluses and minuses, but it did allow more time for reflection. Also, the sense of, we must run with the thing because it's on Twitter. And Twitter consumes itself, I think.
I should ask you about what you did after you left the Times in 2010. Mm. You've become a great ornament of state. You've been a public appointments commissioner. You've been on all sorts of committees and public bodies.
Yeah, well, what happened was, towards the end of my time on the Times, I felt, I was being squeezed a bit. Generational, too. I mean, it goes back to politicians. Your time runs out. And I thought, well, my time was running out. There's a new think tank called the Institute for Government being established. I'd be the first person to write about it, actually. And I happened to bump into the research director, and I said, how's it going? He said, well, we're looking around for research fellows. And I pointed to myself. I said, he said, we'd love to have you. And as I negotiated a deal working 2 days a week for the Institute for Government for my last 18 months on the Times, and 3 days a week on the Times. I also, the most extraordinary thing of all, my last day on the Times, I got a phone call from the late Jeremy Hayward, who was then Permanent Secretary at Number 10, saying, we're setting up an inquiry into detainees and rendition, which is Guantanamo and all that. We'd like you to serve on it. I said, what? I was just packing up my stuff that day. And being Jeremy, I said, how long have I got to think about it? He said, now. And that sounded a good thing to do. And it was the most extraordinary thing. And I also got a time, over that weekend, they made me a Privy Councillor, which much amused my Times colleagues. I remember when it was announced in the Commons the following Tuesday, they thought it was very funny. Probably quite right. So I had that. Then I became director of the Institute for Government, ran it for 4 years, 4.5 years. And then I wanted to move on, and the position of Public Appointments Commissioner came up. So I applied for that, got it, and that was fascinating. I mean, I'm extremely fortunate to have done totally different things in my 60s and early 70s. But to get another perspective on things. I mean, you know, I realised my time as a journalist was coming to an end. I'd really enjoyed it. People say, which do you prefer? You don't. It's not like that. You do one thing, you enjoy it, and then you do something else, enjoy it.
Given that there's nothing political journalists love more than sitting around and pontificating on what politicians should be doing, or government departments, or, oh, they want to be doing this, or if only I was... Yeah. When you find yourself in those positions, do political journalists know better?
No, I tell you what, the interesting thing is, well, two things. One, having been in the game, I was probably more discreet because I knew when not to talk. So I fortunately never got myself too much trouble on that, much to the annoyance of some old friends.
I often find if any journalist who becomes a senior spin doctor or something, they're always the worst.
I know, exactly. I mean,
they won't speak at all.
No, but the answer is, political journalists, with all their contacts, on the whole, get the direction right. They know which direction the submarine's going in. But they're not, on the whole, on the outside, they don't always get the exact timing right. But on things I was involved in quite closely, on the whole, they got the fact there was a row, but they didn't always get the details of the row or when it would be resolved. Sometimes they're ahead of the game. You know, I was being phoned up and said, X is going to happen. And I knew perfectly well X was still 2 or 3 weeks away. Or that X had already happened.
I suppose it's one of those things where the first draft of history is bound to be a bit rough and ready.
Yeah, but it's nonetheless not bad. Not bad. I mean, you know, on the whole, a lot of political journalists still very assiduous, hardworking, and you know, when there's a row, they're generally not wrong.
Peter Middell, that feels like a good note to end it on. Thanks so much for joining us on the Political Editors on Times Radio.
Pleasure.
That was Sir Peter Riddle. In episode 4, Philip Webster, the longest serving political editor of the whole series, uncovering the rise and fall of New Labour. His episode and the entire series is available now wherever you're listening to this. But for now, from me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessionals, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.